Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We are very, very excited today. Alex, who have we got?
This is brilliant. So Mary-Ann Lund is with us. She's an associate professor in Renaissance English Literature at the University of Leicester. So she's a historian and a published author. Her most recent book is Melancholy, Medicine and Religion in Early Modern England. So essentially, I guess what we're going to talk about today is Renaissance mental health to a certain extent. Is that right?
It is, absolutely. Hello, Alex. Hello, Alina.
Lovely to see you. So how did you get into this subject?
Goodness me. Well, a long time ago when I was doing my doctorate, it was on Robert Burton's The Anatomy of Melancholy, a book that I'd become a little bit obsessed about when I was doing my master's. It's an absolutely whopping book. It's a real doorstop of a read. And I never come up against a book that was so indefinable. In lots of ways, it's, you know, it's a literary text, and I'm principally a literary scholar, but it's about medicine, obviously. It's historical, it's got religious things, it's got a lot of jokes in it and philosophy, so it's a real mix. And I got interested in the idea about how mental health was regarded and treated in a time when there weren't psychologists, psychiatrists, people who had a specialism in that particular kind of thing. So they approached it very much through thinking about body, mind and soul.
Could you define melancholy for us?
That's a good idea. That's where we start.
Yeah.
Well, melancholy literally, I mean, it means black bile, and it's from the Greek. And it's from the concept of the four humours. So we think back to Galen and before that to Hippocrates. The idea that our bodies have these four fluid substances. We've got blood, choler, melancholy or black bile, and last of all phlegm. And in healthy people, they're in this ideal balance that keeps us alive and makes us kind of moderate and healthy. But if one of them gets out of whack, you get more of one humour than the other, then that can affect your physical health, but also your mental health. So melancholy itself as a disease is a kind of a mental illness, dotage. Robert Burton calls it in The Anatomy of Melancholy. It's not a feverish thing, so it's not about you becoming frenzied, but it's accompanied for most kind by sorrow and fear. So you can feel sad, but you also can feel frightened. The nearest modern equivalent would be sort of depression and anxiety, but you can't make direct connections, I think, between melancholy and our present categorization of mental illnesses, because we tend to give lots more words to something that back then had this kind of one catch-all term, if you like, melancholy. So it's very much physically rooted in lots of ways, but it's also a disease that had many different permutations to it.
So is it Democritus or Democritus Junior? Who was he and how does he fit into the narrative?
Okay, so when Robert Burton wrote The Anatomy of Melancholy, which came out first in 1621, 400 years ago, he published it not under his own name. He published it under the name of Democritus Junior. And in doing that, he was saying that he was heir of an ancient Greek philosopher. Democritus was the laughing philosopher, who was kind of the pair of Heraclitus, the weeping philosopher. And the idea behind that was that he said Democritus looked at the world and all its madness and its follies, and his response is to laugh at it. So it's kind of satirical in some ways, whereas Heraclitus cried and, you know, and mourned its follies. In fact, Burton, by taking on that kind of mantle, he actually says that really a mixed passion is what you need as a response to the world. So what you're seeing here is, on the one hand, we're talking about a mental disease that affects individuals. But he's also making a claim that melancholy is something that affects the whole world. So that Democritus role is one that he takes on. He gets it from Erasmus, the great 16th century humanist, scholar, philosopher, author, playful individual. Because in Erasmus's Praise of Folly, the character of Folly herself says that we need 1,000 Democrituses to kind of mock and laugh at the world's folly, because there is so much of it. And even then, we'd always need one more. So when Burton wrote The Anatomy of Melancholy, he said, I'm one of these. I'm Democritus Junior. But there's also another more particular thing about mental illness with Democritus. And Burton tells us a story about that. He says that when he take this from the kind of Hippocratic letters, that the people of Abdera were concerned about their sort of local friendly philosopher Democritus had himself gone mad. So they sent Hippocrates along to go and see him and have a chat with him. And Hippocrates finds Democritus sitting in a garden cutting up dead animals. And
like you do.
Like you do, yes, it's a bit of leisure. And he says, what are you doing? And Democritus says, I'm looking for the source of the world's madness, of what's wrong with everybody. Because look at the world, everyone's obsessed with getting what their neighbours have. Everyone's envious, everyone's complaining about things. And I'm trying to work out where it is, and I can't cut up humans to do that. So I'm going to cut up animals instead. And work out from then where it might be in us humans. Is it in a particular organ? So Burton has him then, retells that story and says, I'm like Democritus looking for the world's madness and also trying to understand melancholy. Hippocrates afterwards, he goes back to the people of Abdera and says, your philosopher Democritus is not mad at all. He's the wise one.
You've mentioned this already, some of the causes of melancholy, but can you go into a little bit more detail about them for us?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, sorrow and fear are the big ones for melancholy. They're the major sources and kind of accompaniments, if you like. The other really important thing about them is Burton defines melancholy as sorrow and fear without a cause. So it's not necessarily linked to something proportionate that makes you melancholy. It could be something really quite small, a little trigger. There's an extraordinary story in one of the medical textbooks of a preacher in the Netherlands, and he's walking through the fields and he suddenly gets overcome with an attack of diarrhea. So he runs for a ditch, jumps down into the ditch to pull down his trousers and to relieve himself. And then one of his female parishioners comes past and sees him, catches him in the act. And according to this medical story, then they're so horrified, he's so horrified by the shame and the embarrassment of being seen having a liquid poo in a ditch that he takes to his bed and is overcome with melancholy for months on end. So it doesn't need to be anything, you know, majorly significant. Nonetheless, it can be. I mean, it can be some really a natural disaster. There are stories of people who, for instance, got caught up in there was a big earthquake in Bologna in 1504. And one of the stories is of somebody who not only is overcome with the fumes and the horrible event itself, but then he can't get past it and eventually takes his own life. So melancholy is really interesting because they see it in this one name for something that can be all kinds of different permutations and all kinds of causes. Ultimately, I mean, it can even come from your parents, just from the way you're born and your kind of your humoral makeup, or it could be the fact that you're very old that you've become all melancholy. More or less, you know, as many as there are different people in the world, there are different causes and varieties of melancholy.
What's interesting about that then is they already understand that it's the things that happen to you that affect how you are, how you're, they wouldn't have referred to it obviously as how your mental health is, but that's, they're acknowledging that things happen to people and it affects them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that things that are way beyond your control.
Yeah.
I find it very interesting, for instance, that they kind of register the fact that, I mean, perhaps what we might call a kind of the chemical balances of the brain. It's a very different understanding, of course, in the ancient times and through to the Renaissance. But that understanding that there are some things you can't change about yourselves and which really affect you. I should say on the other side that Burton says, well, actually, you can moderate your behaviour. So there is this emphasis, I think, in Renaissance texts on also you do have some responsibility for yourself, and which might be able to kind of do a bit of rebalancing, but it's not going to sort of sort everything out sometimes.
Which of the causes interested you the most when you were writing your book?
I mean, the book that that's coming out early next year is A User's Guide to Melancholy. Mm. And it's a kind of more popular version of some of the work I've done on melancholy and the anatomy of melancholy. And I start each chapter by talking about a case study about an individual story. And I think I must admit that rather than a particular cause, it's the stories that I found quite kind of captivating. There's one extraordinary story of there was a Swiss gentlewoman in Basel who she's out in the streets of the town and sees a pig being butchered, and as the butcher cuts open the pig and the entrails of the pig pour out, she looks, you know, disgusted at it. And this doctor who's standing next to her, who has, you know, clearly has had a tact bypass, says, "See that pig? You're like that pig inside, lady." And she promptly vomits all over the place and goes home, and then takes to her bed. And again, for months upon end, she is trapped in melancholy. And the Swiss physician Felix Platter, who wrote lots of the case studies, kind of really struggled to treat this woman. And I think it's that sometimes there's stories like that, that where the cause is something that you could kind of get it. You could understand why that would be a really horrible moment. But then that in a few cases becomes something that's really long term. It becomes a really chronic condition. And where a kind of moment of basically it's social cruelty, isn't it? That unpleasantness and sort of misogyny really as well in that story that then affect her disproportionately.
They're very relatable, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is those stories about being around and about in the world, the life of towns perhaps, where your neighbours are kind of watching you and you have your social position to consider, or the way people are talking about you. Melancholy is often about that. It's about that sense of what other people think of you, and then what you think they're thinking. Is behind a lot of those stories, and people that become really, really trapped by that and become seriously ill.
So we've talked about the causes. What symptoms could a person have?
A wide range of things. Sometimes it can often be that melancholy exhibits itself not in everything that you do and say and are, but in just in very particular things. So nobody would necessarily notice that you're melancholy except if they saw this one particular aspect of you. So there's an interesting idea actually, the sort of invisible illness and invisible disability that we talk about today. It could be that you are seeking out solitude, or that you don't want to go out so much, don't want to socialise. And that's often actually cause and symptom, that it becomes rather a self-propagating thing. It could be that you have a particular phobia, something that really alarms and scares you. You could, one of the varieties of melancholy is to do with delusion as well, so that you become convinced of something, where in every other respect you might seem quite, you know, normal in quotation marks, but you have this one sort of idée fixe. So there are melancholics who think they're made of glass, for instance, and the stories go that every other respect they seem normal, except that they are terrified of people coming near them because they will break. I think that's a particularly interesting thing to think about in a time of social distancing and pandemic. People who are scared of physical contact or of others coming too close to them, or they're scared of their body's fragility. Likewise, there's a story of somebody who was ill with a physical disease for a very long time, and his doctors cured him of the disease, but they gave him a particular strong smelling medicine. And after that, he became really phobic of this smell, this particular smell of this medicine. But also, once he was well cured of the physical illness, he thought he could smell it everywhere, so kept away from everyone too. So those kind of stories are intriguing ones. Also, you know, people who thought that they were a shellfish or a cockerel, or that they were made of butter, or that they were made a pot, that they had to hold the whole world up like Atlas, you know, literally weighed down by the cares of the world. All kinds of wonderful, weird and wonderful stories that are behind melancholy.
I love the, how traumatic must it have been if you genuinely thought you were made of butter?
Yes, Absolutely. Especially as the man who thought Timet was made of butter, he was a baker in the Italian city of Ferrara. And so he was convinced he was made of butter, and that every time he got too near the fires, where, you know, he's baking his bread, that he would melt, or if he went out in the sunshine. So it's a phobia that's and a delusion that's connected to his whole occupation and his means of making money.
So how do Renaissance people cure this? So they obviously don't have fluoxetine or citalopram. So how did they approach this problem?
I think one of the things that's really interesting about melancholy is they see the whole person in lots of ways. And I don't want to kind of over-modernize past ways of treatment, because there's some stuff that we find really objectionable, but they thought about the treating the body and the mind together, and actually that kind of considering all the aspects of your life. So one aspect would be diet, for instance. Are you eating the right things? There are lots of foods, for instance, that were seen to increase melancholy, like heavy meats, for instance. Hair was a particularly bad thing to eat if you're a melancholic, and likewise kind of things that would be rough and the digestion. So that would be one thing to treat and to get you kind of moderate. Don't drink dark beer, drink white wine, for instance. That would be one thing. It might be, I mean, that there wasn't a kind of counselling thing, but they saw the benefit of spiritual treatment and of kind of talking over things that troubled you, talking to a friend as well. So a sense that the melancholic might be helped not just by a physician, but by all the people around them, your family members, your friends, might help you gently towards a cure. There were medicines as well, things that were prescribed. Hellebore, which is the plant, flowering plant, was recognised since ancient Greece as something that within moderation was good for treating the mind, and some other herbs as well, borage, bugloss, things like that. Physicians differ about them, and some treatments get very complex and they become kind of an arguments and debates about whether they were actually good for you or not. But they had that kind of, I suppose, a slightly global view of how you might be treated, that would take in patterns of behaviour, opening your window, did you live in somewhere that was really cold and damp and marshy? Well, perhaps you needed to move if that was the case. That only works if you're wealthy, of course, and can afford it. But
what's the strangest cure you've come across?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that the strangest that Robert Burton mentions are the ones that involve delusion and treating delusion. So there is a story of a gentleman in Siena who became convinced that if he went to the loo, if he urinated, that he would flood his whole town. He thought that his bladder was so full and enormous that he would just wee everywhere and everybody would drown. And the way that they treated it was actually by sort of entering that story and kind of saying, okay, well, that's going to happen. The doctors went and got the bells in the town to be rung, which is the kind of fire alarm system of Renaissance Siena. And they got someone to light a fire in the house next door so that there'll be wafty smoke. And they got the servants and other people to run around going, fire, fire. And they ran up to this chap's bedchamber and said, you're the only one that can save us. Please go to the toilet now, and then you could put our fire out. And then he did. He relieved his bladder. And the moment he did, his melancholy delusion was cured. And he realised that this was not the case at all. His bladder was not infinitely large. And there are lots of stories like that of Renaissance melancholy. People who thought they were dead, and the doctor gets his assistant to dress up as a corpse and then have some food because the patient won't eat, and say, oh, look, you know, of course the dead can eat. I'm dead and I'm eating. So they enter the reality of the melancholic and then work with them. And these stories get retold because they were seen as, you know, amusing and strange and weird and wonderful. But I think there's also that really interesting sense of compassion for the sufferer, in that they're not going to be cured by persuasion necessarily. So you have to kind of work with the person.
Can I chuck an extra question in here? Because we started to touch on something that really interests me. It's become a lot more acceptable now to have a mental health issue. And we're starting to adjust and improve our responses to people who are suffering from mental health issues. How do people respond to melancholy in the period that you look at?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, in some ways, melancholy had some fashion to it. The Anatomy of Melancholy was published in 6 editions, and it really made Burton. It's the only thing he worked on, more or less. And so I think that book succeeded and became perennially popular because of this interest in mental health and the way that the mind can work on the body. But you often get in doctors' records notes about melancholy in you know, one version or another. I don't think there's a sense of a stigma to melancholy at all. In fact, rather the other way. I mean, you think about those sort of 16th century portraits of gentlemen where it becomes the kind of emo goth thing, you know, they're dressed in black. Black is the colour of melancholy. Mm. And rather styling themselves as that. So it's interesting because on the one hand, there is the almost fashionable posturing as melancholy in the Renaissance that, because you are, you know, lonely and mysterious, but you also have got that touch of genius about you. Melancholy has that link with genius.
Kind of like we've had Carolyn Day on talking about these nutty women in the 18th century who wanted to look like they were dying of TB.
Yeah.
Thing, isn't it? Isn't it odd the way things become fashionable?
Yeah. But I think this is a kind of male version of that. You get people, I'm thinking of Margaret Cavendish, you know, the great 17th century poet, aristocrat poet, and she styles herself as melancholy too. But what's actually really interesting is that in The Anatomy of Melancholy, Robert Burton, he says, yeah, that there is that part of it, of the self-styled melancholic, but it's also serious. This is not something to be trifled with. In fact, he says that there are people who start kind of, you know, being a bit lonely, being not doing anything. And then actually that's the tipping point. They get sucked into the irrevocable gulf and then it becomes really dangerous. You can't get yourself out. So Arthur Burton and his contemporaries, they had no doubt that this was something that could be very serious and indeed lifelong. He claimed himself to be suffering from it. So I think he had that sense of the sufferer speaking out.
So do you think his book made any sort of difference to the way we look at it now?
Yeah, in lots of ways. I mean, from a literary sense, loads of people read it and found it interesting. They read it for the stories. Burton was a great collector of things and a masser of little quotations and stories and other kind of thing. And so in a literary sense, you see that legacy. Lawrence Stern rips some bits off it. Interest from Shandy. John Keats was interested in it. It appears there's a quotation from The Anatomy of Melancholy in Middlemarch and on Anthony Burgess right into the present day, that sort of literary sense of melancholy. I mean, clearly in the long history of how to treat mental health, things change significantly. And it's to do with the professionalisation of medicine. In the early 17th century, when Burton was around, there was a whole range of practitioners, including the kind of licensed physicians, but also unlicensed folk, lay people, healers, people like him. I mean, he wasn't a physician. He was an Oxford College fellow and a priest. But he saw himself as kind of treating melancholy. That was a condition of the soul as well. So I think actually, if you look at the long history of mental health and illness, it becomes much more kind of clinical and professionalized with psychology as a discipline itself. I think sometimes that there is certainly that sense of Burton and melancholy casting a very long shadow. And I think actually sometimes when people look at past treatments and attitudes to mental health, we've got something interesting to learn from them too, about the way that from a social perspective, mental health conditions might be perceived, but also kind of ways of treating it, that it's not just about a kind of a medical treatment, although that's a very important part of it, but also different kinds of things. Reading books, for instance, Burton himself sets up this idea that the anatomy of melancholy is about trying to cure it and curing through reading it, keeping you entertained and occupied.
What kind of so we are source nerds on this programme. What kind of sources did you use to create such a detailed book?
Well, when I was writing The User's Guide to Melancholy, it was very much in tribute and affection towards the anatomy of melancholy itself, because it's Burton's 400th anniversary of the mm-hmm. anatomy of melancholy. And because it could be described as a book of books, he was a scholar who was reading very widely from the whole range of medical history from the ancient times to his present day. So that was obviously my principal source, but I was going back to some of his own sources too and comparing sometimes what he does with them. So other Renaissance physicians, medics writing in Latin or in the vernacular. There was a French physician and English people writing about melancholy too. He's also uses literary sources and philosophy. I mean, he uses people like Petrarch, for instance, and some of the stories that come from there. And, you know, medical case books, I think, formed a large part of it. There are the medical textbooks that are about disease at a general level, causes, symptoms, cures. But there were collections of case histories simply in that kind of Hippocratic medicine, which was about, I treated so-and-so and this is what happened, this is what their symptoms were and this is how I treated them. And then physicians would collect them together so that you could learn something about disease through all of the individual instances. So I did a kind of mix of that, really following in Burton's footsteps.
Tell everybody, is the book out now?
Yeah, User's Guide to Melancholy comes out in February 2021 through Cambridge University Press. It was an absolute joy to write, I must admit. I loved coming back to Burton, having done my doctorate on him quite a while ago, but also digging into those stories. I think the human stories about individuals and, you know, past sufferings, and I think that's a really interesting thing to kind of connect with and uncover, and it was something that Burton was very interested in, and I think also it's why we find Burton so interesting too.
Who'd have thought that we could perhaps learn something from how people in the Renaissance responded to mental health as well?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I have found when I talk about Burton and some of these stories that often people will open up about things that have happened to them by comparison and see those parallels. I was cautious about making them myself because that's not my task as a historian. I think I like to leave those things open for other people to make the connection with their own lives, especially when you're dealing with a subject like mental health. I think you should be, you know, very, very careful about that if you're working on it from a historical perspective and not kind of imposing your own standards and preconceptions when you're looking at past ideas about how mind and body worked. But also, of course, from our own perspective, I think it's interesting for modern readers to make their own links, if you like.
Marianne, I want to thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about melancholy. It was absolutely fascinating getting an insight into what people in the Renaissance period thought about mental health. So thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thank you, Alina. Thank you, Alex.
Join us tomorrow morning for Pole Position, Alina's monthly jaunt into Polish history. This time looks at the Piast dynasty with Darius von Guttner, so don't miss that one. And then in the afternoon, Beth Moore will be banging her drum for the Midlands. She'll be talking all about the early engagements of the 46th Division in World War I.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.